Hello, and welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of a Society of Graduate Students here at Western University. I am one of your hosts, Mark Ambrosio.
And I'm one of your other hosts, Megan Vole.
Megan, I know you're involved in different things here at Western. You're a PhD student in media studies, and you're here at GradCast. Mm-hmm. And you're also working, you work as a teaching assistant, and you also work as a research assistant.
Yes.
So tell me what you do as a research assistant, what project you're working on.
So I'm working on a very interesting project with my supervisor, Dr. Joanna Redden, and what we're looking at is the relationship between data harms and aging. So data harms being any harm that data does, such as privacy breaches or cybersecurity issues, or even something down to mistrust of a corporation because of a privacy breach. Now, what we're trying to figure out is, what does age have to do with data harms, and how does age play into the role to the kinds of data harms we can find or that exist? Now, Mark, I'm not going to get into that because that's a whole other project. Yes. I feel like that's a whole other episode, to be honest. But we are here with someone who does similar research to what I do. Isn't that right?
That is right. A mutual friend of ours and fellow FIM student, Alex Mayhew. Alex is a PhD candidate in library and information science. And Alex's main topic for his dissertation deals with cataloging, doesn't it? An area called phylomimetics, which we talked about last time. But today we're going to talk about one of Alex's many research interests. More specifically, we're going to talk about aging justice. And I'm going to stop because this is about the extent of my knowledge on the topic. And so we'll turn it over to the expert himself, Alex. When we talk about aging justice, what do we mean?
Oh, well, thank you for having me back on again. I just want to point out, I do have the three main research areas. My PhD project is on cataloging systems, so phylomimetics is the name of that. I have the other research area on the future of AI and what we should be doing to prepare about that. Thank you for having me on not too long ago for that. Yeah. And today, yes, aging justice. So this comes out of my actual undergrad work in bioethics and philosophy. And I just feel like we as a society, humanity generally, have a tendency to devalue the welfare and health expectations of people who happen to have been born a long time ago, so older people. If I may, there's a relatively famous science fiction author, Ted Chiang. If you ever saw the movie Arrival, his short story is what that movie was based on.
It's great, great short story and great film.
Yeah, no, it's a great film. And but, you know, he is... It articulates an idea that I think is relatively common. So one of his quotes is, death plays an important role in continuing social evolution. New ideas come from the young. So if people live indefinitely, there would be fewer younger people, either absolutely or proportionally, and so society would stagnate. So I don't know about you, but that sounds kind of ageist. It's like older people can't have new ideas. They can't contribute. And therefore, they should die. I find that a bit problematic. And so I wanted to look at how older people are treated in society through a social justice lens. And I had discovered that there was already a perspective called health justice, which imagines health as being more than just the biochemistry going on in your body, but it's a whole bunch of social factors as well. There's, do you have safe parks that you can go exercise in? Do you have public transportation? So if you know, don't have a vehicle otherwise, you can get to a doctor's appointment, things like that. So this broader perspective of the social factors that go into health seem like a very good thing to pay attention to if you're trying to think about health generally. However, a giant gap in health justice, which, if I recall correctly, was written by a person named Venkatapuram, does great work, but he doesn't talk about aging. And age is one of the biggest factors in how one experiences health. There's a lot of medical conditions that manifest mostly in people who were born a long time ago as opposed to people who were born more recently.
Now, I'm going to put a question to you because I think when you think of aging justice, which is which will be a new term for most of our listeners, but I think we may think of specific manifestations. But then I think you're also dealing with something which is very philosophically very deep here. So like a specific manifestation, think for example, as Ontario was sort of, you know, in the process of reopening, closing, reopening. And there was a, in the last couple of years from COVID-19, there was a phase briefly where, okay, we're reopening, but you need to show proof of vaccination to enter a restaurant. And large segment of the population are like, okay, how do I do that? You know, how do I download that? How do I print that off? And it was, to me, the role struck me as ageist, because some of the older, our older population who may not have internet at home, who may not be, you know, up to date on, like, what is a QR code?
Or a smartphone.
Or a smartphone, because, right. You know, like, initially the communication was like, and after a while, they're like, okay, we're dropping the paperwork and just show your smartphone. And it's like, and I bristled against that because, well, read the fine print. You don't need to show a smartphone. You can still show the paperwork. But it was the assumption in the principal communications was that we all have smartphones and we all know what a QR code is. And the whole thing struck me as very ageist. What's happening there?
Well, I think there's a bunch of things happening there. As you mentioned, there is a lack of support and understanding of the preferred ways of doing things of people who are no longer the, let's say, target demographic for politicians or advertisers or whatever else is deemed to be valuable. And you know, these people, generally speaking, aside from certain cognitive conditions, are fully capable of interacting and learning and participating in all of life's opportunities. I mean, there are important physical and mental conditions that are worth talking about, and I think we'll get to them later. But for the most part, like, we should just recognize that it's not that they are us; it's that there is no they in us. We're all just humans trying to get along, and if we're putting a circle around a group of people and saying we don't care about supporting you, well, humans have done that to a lot of different groups, and for a society that pretends to be enlightened, and we say, you know, we're not going to do that to genders or races or all the other things. It's quite notable that we're pretty happy to keep doing that to, again, people who happen to have been born a long time ago. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I don't think that's good.
No, and it seems to be almost the last acceptable form of discrimination.
It has been called that.
But it's growing in scholarship and literacy. It's becoming a more recognized, I'd argue, form of discrimination. Is that correct?
It is, though I would say that there is this concept in critical race theory of internalized racism, and there's internalized sexism. If you go back, for example, to the history of women getting the right to vote in the United mm-hmm. States, one of the biggest campaigners against women getting the right to vote was a woman. And like that's very weird. And you see something somewhat analogous in some of the discussions around the rights of older people. So I see people who are, you know, chronologically born quite a while ago, mm-hmm. saying things very much like Ted Chiang says, and I just look at them and say, you know what you're saying about yourself, right?
Well, what are they saying? Like, I'm curious when you say you've heard people.
Well, they say things. I can't give it a direct quote right now because I don't think that would be appropriate.
An appropriate paraphrase, though.
Yes, something along the lines of, older people should get out of the way to make room for younger people.
Okay.
And we have articles. We can look in the, I think it was the New York Times. I'd have to look it up. Could have been the Atlantic, where a fairly famous philosophy professor said something along the lines of, why I want to die at 65. It's like, okay, that's perspective. And then you have another article, which I have a lot more sympathy for, saying, I just turned 90. Don't tell me to die. So, yeah. And I liked her article a whole lot better.
Yeah. No, see, now my question is, we talked a lot, you had mentioned, sorry, mm-hmm. We're taking a step back here. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned this idea of older individuals mm-hmm. not having value in society. They're not the target demographic for a lot of advertising, et cetera, et cetera. And I have heard that in a lot of, let's say, older people who are also not working anymore, so mm-hmm. retired or just no longer working. So my kind of question is, when you talk about aging justice, are you approaching it from, let's say, a political economy or Marxist perspective?
Not particularly. I do think those are important lenses to mm-hmm. make use of and take a look at. The more ways you can look at a challenge, the better. I'm actually looking at this challenge through a modification of the health justice lens. So Venkatapuram makes use of what's called the capabilities approach or the capacities approach, which is to say that when you examine a person's life, mm-hmm. they have certain capacities. They are able to move around. They're able to act with autonomy. They're able to make decisions. There's a whole list of these. And one of the uses of the health justice approach is to say, well, if we aren't supporting people well, then we are restricting their capacities. We're making it so that they cannot do the things that younger people would have been able to do. Well, healthy people were able to do. And then aging justice, there are all sorts of factors that make it so older people are not able to do the things that younger people are able to do. You know, the extending the lens. And some of that, more and more of that, is a result of social factors. So just to give, you know, the example of the mm-hmm. moment, tuberculosis, we know how to cure it.
Yep.
Why is it so prevalent? Because we've not chosen to put the money in to just cure it. Like, we don't make sure that the health agencies around the world are given enough money. We could. And similarly, aging is more and more falling under the domain of we have abilities to intervene medically into the aging process,
mm-hmm.
and we have abilities to intervene into the social structures, which include things that are upstream of the aging process, to make it so that people who happen to have been born a long time ago retain their capabilities to have autonomous life. And I tend to focus on the actual biological component, just because I think that is an under-examined element of this. Much of the health justice framework also applies to people who are elderly, mm-hmm. and I'm glad that work is being done. I'm trying to look at the area that is, in my view, overlooked.
Okay, so let's dive into the biological component a little more. What more does that entail?
Right, so if I were to say, like, a paraphrase of my position is, like, we should make it so that aging was optional. You could choose your biological yeah. age, something mm-hmm. like that. That would be met with some level of skepticism, some level of even derision.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think that that is just inherently a bad idea. And so I want to be very careful about how we're going through that. The first question I always get is something along the lines, is that even possible? And the simple answer is no with a but. It is not possible right now to medically intervene into the aging process and, say, make a person biologically 10 years younger. We can't do that. There's some guy out in California who claims, no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. There's so many grifts and scams out there, so you have to be really, mm-hmm. really, really careful. But it is pretty clear that it is in principle possible to biologically intervene into the aging process. And there is, this is the other part that's it's a little bit confusing, is that there is no medical difference between the aging process and the diseases of old age.
Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on that a bit, sure. if I may, because I think what you, like, on the one hand, we think of aging justice, we think of specific things like, for example, scan the QR code to get in here,
mm-hmm.
which even for young people, it seems that everybody has a smartphone, and not only a smartphone, but not all smartphones can necessarily read QR codes. and then, you know, it excludes huge swaths of the population. And then afterwards, people may think about it like a few months later, oh yes, okay, well, for elderly people who may not have, are less likely to have, go to your library, print off this. And it's very disenfranchising. So there's specific things that you're sort of speaking to, I feel, whether directly or indirectly. But I think you're touching on some broader philosophical topics here For the benefit of our listeners, Alex published a paper in the Canadian Journal of Practical Philosophy in 2021 called Aging Justice, Health Justice Extended, which I think is a very interesting title. And in it, you talk about, for example, so we tend to view healthcare as being treating, as you say, diseases. Mm-hmm. And so somebody who's healthy, it's the absence of disease.
Right.
And just to finish that thought, if I may, really quickly, and we tend to treat, as you say, aging is conveniently considered to be a category apart from maladies. But what you're suggesting is that we perhaps a more holistic view of healthcare that includes treating aging.
This is one of the reasons why I really like the Aging Justice Framework, because it has a holistic view of health. If we go back to the capacities approach generally, then having older people be supported in being able to access restaurants, as you were mentioning earlier, is an example of making sure that people maintain their capacities. And so if we come back to what impinges upon the capacities of older people, we have those social factors, and then we have the actual biological reality of what's going on inside of their bodies. And so far, this is the part that really, you know, bakes my noodle, is that something is only considered a disease if it affects less than 50% of the population, like by definition.
Oh.
And it's a definitional thing. So the fact that what happens in biology is as soon as you're born, before that even, your various tissues in your body build up various types of damage. The Hallmarks of Aging paper, one of the highest cited paper in all of the biology of aging several years ago now, divvies it up into 9 types of damage. It doesn't really matter. There's some people who say 7, some people say 11. Regardless, these types of damage build up in the body. We can talk about them if you like. They're biological minutiae. The point is, they are increasingly able to be subjected to medical intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the thing, the phenomenon, the collection of phenomena that actually underpin the diseases of aging. So when you have a buildup of plaques in your arteries and that causes a heart attack, there are exceptions, but that effectively doesn't happen to younger people. And the biological reality means that it does happen to older people, but it doesn't have to. Like, we can choose to intervene in the buildup of damage. But instead, what we do right now is we focus on treating the symptom. When the damage has reached pathological levels, we create interventions that treat the pathology. But the damage is still building up. So even if you're able to successfully manage that particular condition, all the other types of damage are building up, and you're just going to get something else eventually. Like the old joke is, the best way to reduce heart attacks is to kill all the oncologists. 'Cause
oh God!
Yeah, it's like, well, that shows the power of social influence. Mm-hmm. And so I'm saying that if we rethought about the nature of the relationship between aging and the diseases of aging to show that it's all one thing, then it's how we are approaching it is very much a social construct. We decided to think of them as separate. If we think of them as one thing, we might focus our efforts on mitigating and repairing the damage of aging, and that would have the effect of biologically reducing people's age, not chronologically, obviously.
But yeah, I find that. Thank you, Alex. That's very, I think I encapsulate better than I ever could. Because you think about it, it's very interesting because I think about some of our symptoms of aging, like creaky knees or respiratory problems or heart problems. All these things in and of themselves can be addressed, mm-hmm. but we're not considering them holistically. And there seems to be an institutional reluctance, and part of it may be however you think of healthcare. And again, healthcare is the absence of disease. It seems to be very negative. I mean, it's traditionally how we're viewing it. It seems to be, it's a very negative view rather than a holistic or more positive view.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there, because like medicine is very conservative. The first rule is do no harm.
Yes.
And that's really sensible if you don't know how the system is working, if anything, any intervention you attempt is more likely to cause harm than not, being very cautious is very wise. And I think that we are largely still at that point right now. We don't actually know how to intervene into the buildup of these different types of damage reliably to the point where we could do it safely so that we would be able to actually restore the biological capacities to people that have lacked them due to the buildup of damage. But there are other organisms that are able to do this, and there are some prototype interventions that do exist. So it looks like the path is open if we chose to take it.
Thank you.
Now, a couple things struck me, Alex, that I'm going to first probably go on a rant for about like 2 minutes.
Please
and
do.
Then I will get to the questions that I was going to get to. The first thing, Mark brought up this idea of healthcare is the absence of disease. Now, when he said that, what struck me was...
With footnotes beside that.
With footnotes beside it. What struck me was that that could also apply to aging, too. Youth is the absence of disease, whereas oldness, elderly nature, is the... now I lost the word.
Accumulation
of disease. Thank you. And that connection had never really been made to me. The other was this idea of damage. And in the healthcare industry. Now, I've seen examples of that. I'm not going to go into who it was, but I know someone who got knee surgery. Mm-hmm. And because he was over the age of 65 years old, the doctor actually told him, I'm going to do it, but technically I'm not supposed to.
Wow.
Because once you're over the age of, I forget if it was 65 or not, but it was in that decade, it's considered not worth it because you're probably not going to live long enough that its value or worth is worth even doing the procedure. But he got it done anyway. And I thought that was a bit ageist in itself.
Mm-hmm. There's this idea of quality-adjusted life years and like how much one of them costs. It's a bit of a challenge, yeah.
Well, and that was directly related to quality of life because this particular individual played a lot of sports. Mm-hmm. And for him, that was directly correlated to his quality of life. And the other thing was from your paper, and I hope... I'm going to read the quote because it struck me yesterday when I was reading it and it strikes me today, is under one of your objections, you write aging is natural as an objection to your argument for aging justice. And what you write as a response is this is simply the naturalistic fallacy. Many phenomena are natural and bad. Smallpox was natural and its extinction was unnatural. In an age when dominant discourses are regularly being challenged and the injustices they perpetuate are being exposed, it is curious that the idea that aging is natural has remained so unquestioned. And that really struck me because I had never, we're always told aging is the most natural thing. The only certain thing in life is death. So.
And taxes.
And taxes, death and taxes. Yes. So would your argument suggest that we could cure aging or we could make it better, more?
I definitely wouldn't use the word cure. No matter what intervention we come up with, the damage would still accumulate. You'd have to periodically get it repaired, at least in any foreseeable scenario. But the idea would be that the naturalistic fallacy is very pernicious. There's a reason why I included a selection of common objections to what I would to the argument that I put forward in the paper. People really think that the naturalness of something is a knockdown argument for its beneficence. And it's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
I like rainbows and I like puppies yawning. Natural, great, I love them.
Mm-hmm.
But cancer is natural. Smallpox is natural. Better off without it. I know that's... I'm a little disappointed I have to say this. I know that's a controversial opinion, but I really don't think it should be. And the fact that one of the problems I have to go back to is that aging has two very different meanings. One is this biological concept of the accumulation of damage that leads to pathology. And the other is maturation. So it's going from a child to an adult. And there's sort of a philosophical continuation of that, which is a person continues to learn and gain wisdom and knowledge over time. And there's no reason those two have to continue to be linked. Mm-hmm. They currently are, but it seems to be to me that it'd be better if they weren't and that people were empowered to have the choice to be biologically whatever age they wanted to be. I mean, we have similar discussions in other areas where, you know, people should have the bodies they want to have.
And you meet a lot of elderly people who would probably like a better quality of life than they have. Is that right?
Some that I've met, for sure. And the other thing I would say is, if there would, it is important to note that any sort of these interventions would almost certainly be super expensive at first. I would probably only go to the ultra wealthy at first. And to that I say, thank you for being a guinea pig and actually providing some value to the rest of us. That's cynical. I apologize for that. But like many other technologies, they would decrease in cost over time. And the idea is that we should make them the ability to intervene in the aging process, to restore people's capabilities to what they want them to be, as widely available as possible, as soon as possible, so that people can lead the lives they actually want to lead. And there's going to be a large number of people who wouldn't want to opt in. And to them, I say, live your best life.
But they have the choice.
They have the choice.
And that's the important
thing. That would be the important part. And right now, nature isn't giving us a choice.
No.
Alex, I wanted to ask you, you're a man of many interests. And what is there something about the Library and Information Science program or discipline which facilitates interdisciplinary inquiry?
Well, there's, I would say, a bunch of things. One of them is that the old joke is library science is everyone's second career. So we all bring in our previous experience, and that makes for a delightful potluck of options.
Because there is no LIS undergraduate program.
Yes. But it also, I think, attracts a certain, for lack of a better term, generalist mentality. Mm-hmm. We like seeing the connections between different things. I mean, we obviously have some specialists, and they do great work, and I'm glad we have them, because they're great to cooperate with and collaborate with. But there's a lot of us who just want to see the big picture, and it's a great place to be able to do, I would say, interesting side projects like aging justice, especially since we have our association with the Health Information Science program.
Very true.
I like how you described it as a potluck. That's an interesting little way to describe
it. I'm hungry now.
We'll get to eat soon.
Yes.
Just before, because we're running a bit out of time, I think, I just want to ask maybe a going forward question. How do we go forward with your idea of aging justice and health justice? What would be some feasible, tangible things?
Right. So I think the name of the game is normalization. So we can look to various other social justice movements in the past, gay rights movement, trans rights movement, racial justice. And obviously they're not done by any stretch of the imagination, but they challenge dominant narratives. Now, what we have the opportunity to do is challenge another dominant narrative about the naturalness and therefore goodness of aging, and we just make that part of the conversation. When someone says something ageist, you just say, hey, that's not okay. You know, people should, in principle, have the right to have the bodies that they want to have, and there are material conditions that prevent that right now, but we should work on rectifying that as we do with the others.
I think if I may, a brief rhetorical question I think we can all ask ourselves is everyone welcome at the table?
If someone's going to sit down and say they are unable to be moved from the idea that old people should die, I'm not sure how I can really have a conversation with them. But as long as you're open to the possibility that at least other people should have the right to be the age that they want to be, then, I'd be willing to talk to almost anyone.
And this has been quite an interesting conversation, both for my own research and just in general, because it's a really interesting idea you've put forth here.
Excellent.
And I think for our listeners, we'll have the journal that we quoted throughout the show and that we talked about in the show notes, should they want to read it.
Yeah, please read my article. get my analytics up.
All right. And with that, this has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been one of your hosts, Megan Vole, and my other host was Mark Ambrosio, and we've been speaking with Alex Mayhew. And this episode is produced by Susie Lee. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or TikTok now at GradCast Radio. To listen to us, we're on Radio Western at 94.9 FM. You can also find all of our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yes, and thank you, Alex, for joining us.
Yes, Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to have you back.
Glad to be here.